This panel is on MMOs and learning, and asking some questions about whether there's anything new and interesting here. At what stage are we in the process in trying to understand how to deal with these things? Is the obvious kind of first steps that we need to start taking, and we'll hear some things about the ways in which we might do this, whether there are any new ways of doing things, whether there are any particular implications about the connection between play and learning generally, and whether that causes some issues for the way in which the normal approach to the business of learning, the business of teaching, and the business of knowledge has anything to do with these MMOs. Okay, so we have Doug Thomas from USC, will be talking first. We have Lauren Gelman from Stanford, who will be second, and we have Aaron Delwich, right?
Right.
I always say it's something Delwicky, but Delwich, right? From Trinity, will be third. Give us some context for these particular questions. And as for all of the panels, obviously we're interested in all the discussion, which I will have to moderate, unfortunately, because I didn't find a moderator for this panel. So
I'm hoping I might. I was told to drink tea with honey, and it would help. And I was told by a druid, so it must be right. When I started working on games and learning, the first question I was asked, and I've been asked, I think, in every context since, is, yeah, but what about the question of transfer? How does stuff inside the game get into the heads of kids or players or whoever it is that's playing the game? How do we know learning's actually happening? And I came across a post on a forum which explained to me what the problem was. And it's a long quote. I'll just sort of leave it up there for a few moments to let you process this. And it's about the problem of direct transfer and the question of whether or not World of Warcraft is a good medium for learning. And this person seemed to suggest it wasn't because it's a poor environment for learning. You get distracted easily. There's too much, as he says, extraneous load. And that you're, you know, having to deal with sound and you're having to deal with images, and it's very hard to teach goal-based instruction and so on. And I thought, actually, what this person's saying is exactly right. That games are terrible environments, not for learning, but for teaching. If you want to create a game with a specific message that kids get, or that adults get, or that anyone gets, the first thing most gamers are going to do is figure out how to subvert that. Right? I mean, that's what we all do. Right? So, in terms of direct transfer, I'm not sure that there's no direct transfer. I'm not sure it's predictable. I am sure it's not a very good way for us to think about what's happening in terms of learning. So, if that's a too limited notion, I started asking myself the question, what are games good at? And the thing that games are really good at is grabbing people's imagination. And when they stop grabbing your imagination, they cease to be fun, and you cease to learn, and you usually quit. So, I did some work with co-author John Seeley Brown on this question, and we came to the conclusion that rather than direct transfer, what really people are learning in games is dispositional. And I asked teachers if you could have a game which taught a kid to learn multiplication, would you prefer that, or would you rather have a game that taught a kid how to learn, where a kid learned to love math? Pretty easy call for a teacher, right? Because once they love math, it's very easy to teach them multiplication. So we tried to think about how it is that games set dispositions. And one of the models we came up with comes from Mark Turner in a book called Beyond the Literary Mind, where he talks about the notion of conceptual blending. And conceptual blending suggests if you have two different frames of reference, example he uses is human speech and an animal like a donkey, right? We have no problem watching Shrek where you put those together. The idea of a talking donkey doesn't provide any kind of problem for us cognitively. That MMOGs, then, I think, in a lot of ways, can become spaces for us that provide a kind of both-and, both the real and the virtual, both inside and outside, and so on. And because they're not competing frames, we're able to have very deep and rich vividness, both in the real world and in the virtual world at the same time. They don't conflict, right? So rather than thinking about how things move from the inside to the outside or the real to the virtual, we could think about how it is that we get this vividness of each in this blended space that we're calling a virtual world, which is neither just inside nor outside. And you can think of some very interesting moments when you're playing, excuse me, when people type things like AFK
or BioBreak, right? BioBreak tells us a huge amount of information, sometimes more than we want to know. Right? But it has this amazing vividness in both realms, because we know exactly what that means in the real world, but we also know that means that character will be immobilized, unable to do anything, cannot respond, is in some ways helpless, vulnerable, and so on. Right? So, and we don't have a moment, we don't say, wait a minute, but an avatar doesn't have a keyboard, how could it be possible that they're away from, you know, we don't have that conflict, we just accept it immediately. So, coming out of this notion of dispositions, we've also looked at the idea that there's a kind of traditional split between what we could call critical and productive dispositions. A critical disposition is one which asks us, how do we interpret information? So if you think of something like textual analysis, right, that's a pretty good critical disposition. You get a text, you figure out what it means, how it impacts you, what the metaphors are, and so on. And if you think about a productive disposition, that's closer to something like engineering, right, where you ask, how do I build or create something according to the needs of others? So with a critical disposition, you look inward for interpretation. It would be absurd for Picasso to say, how do I make a painting that everyone loves? Right. But if an engineer has to design a device, they don't say, I'm going to create a beautiful user interface that only means something to me and is unusable by anyone else. Right. So they always have to look outward. So one of the places or spaces where I think something really interesting happens is, what do we do with that? And this is a couple of mods in World of Warcraft, which in this example is Loot Link, which shows me, you know, what loot I'm wearing, what's out there, how much it's worth in the auction house, what the average bids are. All of this is stuff that comes out of user-created add-ons. Right? And for those of you who play World of Warcraft, my guess is that all of you have a fairly sophisticated UI where you've added different modules based on different needs, classes, how you play, what you play, what's important to you, whether you raid, whether you play the auction house, and so on. And in many ways, what's happening is that you're fusing both a critical and a productive disposition. But you're doing it in a very different, I think, interesting way. You're learning how to process information that's kind of constantly pushed at you, and then you're building things in relation to specific, personal, and contingent needs. So if I was to show you my user interface, I won't because it's embarrassingly weird and complex, and probably badly designed, it might not make very much sense to you. And likewise, I could identify the mods that you're using, but I wouldn't know why you've put certain windows and buttons and things where you put them. Right. But they make a lot of sense to you, and that's the only thing that matters. So we're entering an era of information design and interface design where kids and adults are learning how to deal with this intersection of a productive and a critical disposition. And I can't think of too many other spaces in which that happens. So I think kids today are learning about a new kind of disposition towards information. Not only that I have to understand what it means, but that I can do things with it. I can organize around it. Right? I can process it and organize it in ways that are meaningful to me, specific to me, and contingent upon different situations, which I think is a very powerful form of learning. The last thing I want to say is I think we need to pay a lot of attention to the notion of the boundaries of learning and communities of practice. How it is that people are learning. Where learning happens, for example. I mean, it certainly happens in world. But is that post-mortem out? It's not a very good place to teach people. You may be learning what DPS is and what sword's better than what sword and those kind of things. That's the trivial part of what's happening in terms of these environments. You're learning a lot of social skills. You're learning how to pay attention to other people. You're learning how to engage in a kind of complex notion of agency which emerges out of very difficult, sometimes, situations. But you're also learning about the boundaries between worlds. What kind of persona you can have in a forum space in relation to a world space, or on a guild page, or in guild chat versus private chat versus public chat. There's a very sophisticated level or set of levels of communication protocols that happen in world. Right. And all of those things are learning environments. And ultimately, you're learning in the boundary spaces around the game, the forums, the websites, the wikis, the thoughtbots, and so on. You're not just learning the information. Right? There's something really powerful, I think, about the idea that a player learns to play the game by going to Alakazam or going to Thoughtbot and understanding that the information in the game is only a part of the picture. So it's about mobilizing resources as well in order to solve complex problems. So I want to sort of end by saying I think what's happening in games in terms of learning is that games are much better at setting dispositions than teaching predictable content, that we need to focus our attention on the question of games and learning, not games and teaching, and I think they're very different questions. I also think it means that as instructors, a lot of us need to learn how to get out of the way. Because the learning that's happening is something that's going to come from internal motivations from our students, much more than whatever it is that we think is important that we're going to direct them toward. And finally, we need to come up with new models, thinking about how learning happens and what's valuable about it. Because I think these kind of spaces are fundamentally transforming the nature of what learning is. And if my colleagues are any indication, and your colleagues as well, I think there's going to be a lot of resistance to the kind of learning that can happen in games. And we really need to come up with, I think, a sophisticated vocabulary to help us position it in terms of what learning is, what teaching is, in terms of the academy today. So, thanks.
So, I just wanted to show you this. I don't have a PowerPoint or a video, but... Okay, well, in any event, you can if you wanted to go to this site, you can look at the different pictures. Here's me, my avatar, in front of State of Play Academy, which is where we've been doing our classes. And these pictures were taken by Jean, who's sitting in the audience over there. So so that you can, for people who, what I'm going to talk about in terms of education in virtual worlds is very different than what Doug was just showing. This is how it looks when we have it. This is a talk that was given by a journalist about an article that he did, and he dressed up in a police uniform. These are the people who showed up for the class. You could see text bubbles go by. This all happens in there.com, which is completely voice-enabled, so we have the opportunity to use both voice and text. So that's the show and tell portion. What we're doing, it's State of Play Academy. It was sort of started by Beth and David, and take advantage of some of the ideas that came out of previous State of Play conferences. And the goal is to create a learning environment where we can give more people access to the kinds of conversations that are happening in this room, basically. And I got involved in the project not because I'm a longtime gamer, but I'm someone who's really interested in speech and how technology impacts opportunities for increased conversations and communication. And I think that this, what's happening with virtual worlds, is a new door that's sort of opening up to allow more conversations to happen among different people. And the question is that we're trying to address is how can we take advantage of this space to teach about law and technology differently, giving access to more people, taking advantages of the aspect of place to change the kind of teaching that we're doing. And we allow a symposium like this, where it's great for all of us to physically get together, and then you have the Terra Nova blog, and I spent a lot of time researching blogs as a different kind of means of communication. But now maybe there's some sort of intermediary aspect where it's not, these aren't two different binary options, but there's a place in between. So we've had 10 classes since we started teaching in August, and on a variety of different subjects, from people giving presentations about papers they've written about patent law or about architecture and policy. I did a class on legal issues for bloggers that we had a lot of people who are bloggers show up to, and trying to think about what kind of audience that we is out there of people who are interested in learning something about the law, but not wanting to go to law school. So, I mean, it's sort of similar to the earlier panel today, who's like a really good update on tax law, and it might be something that's really useful to all of you in your work, but you don't want to go to law school in order to get that information. And there really isn't a lot of venues out there that offer an opportunity to just go in and take a class on tax law and learn something and do it in a situation like the virtual world. So sometimes I call what we're doing a bit like distance ed on steroids. So it has aspects of what traditional distance ed is like, in that the idea is to offer education to more people, but it has all the benefits of synchronous education. So everybody's in the same class at the same time, able to ask questions of the professor, learn from their rest of the students, and take advantage of the, speaking to the choir, there's something different about being in here and having this than being on a conference call. I haven't figured out how to describe what that is, but there is something different, and the engagement in the conversation is much different when you're looking at different people as they're talking, people's mouths move as they're talking. So that's what we're doing. We've had lots of fun with this. I've been, hit by paintballs while teaching as people from the community have driven by. I'd never been hit by a paintball before, and I didn't know I should have my shield on to protect me from this, and all of a sudden found myself all the way across the campus. People hoverboard in and out of class, or sort of hoverboard in the background as they drive by to see what we're doing. All of our classes are free and open to anybody who wants to come in. I post messages on the their message boards. I post messages on the SLED mailing list. We have avatars that are pre-configured that people can, borrow and use for the class. People arrive. Almost all the people who take our classes have never been in a virtual world before they show up to take a class. So it's a really different kind of experience where, you're dealing with the technology of getting them acclimated enough to sort of pop into this space. They're jumping around as the patterns are loading. And figuring out how to deal with this, to deal with a virtual world classroom experience where you're trying to attract not just natives of the world, but you're trying to bring more people into something that they're not used to. These videos were sort of made partially to show people what it's going to be like when they get there. But these are some of the things that we're dealing with. The lessons that we've learned, I have three that I'll say, although there's just so many. One, it's really nice for teaching to be able to add some granularity to the kinds of classroom experiences that people can get. So our students could come in for one class and then leave. It's not like a huge commitment. We can have reading on our website that we have in advance, and people can do that or not. We can, there's so much conversation just going on generally in the academy about revisiting the whole issue of higher education and rethinking. I mean, it hasn't really been rethought in a really long time, and starting to rethink, how do people learn and integrating different things in. And I think that, we're able to experiment in this space with different kinds of classroom, have people in class, give them an assignment, have them go out, have them come back for a second class, and that could be the whole thing. I mean, how much time does it take to teach something? We can teach in exactly that amount of time. The second thing is that there enables us to use voice and text. And this really creates a very rich experience because for so many reasons. One, it really has turned everything we've done from classes into conversations. And in our relaunch that we're doing, we are going to reconceive everything we're doing as conversations, because that's really what ends up happening. There isn't, you have the teacher can start talking and, you know, maybe try to get 5 minutes of, like, the bullet points of, like, what you want people to get out. But then you have, you know, people start with the text bubbles, typing in, you know, what their feedback is. I mean, it's really nice as a teacher to be able to talk to students and have them give you some feedback, you know, and it's, you're not just staring at blank faces. You don't know if they're getting it. They, you know, type a little question mark, or they type, I don't know what that means, and you can readjust your talking as they do that. And then you also have the sort of more formal, you know, raise your hand and get called on and ask a question. And different students like to take advantage of different aspects of these. And so you have this constant flow back and forth, and back and forth between students that's happening, that's very different than when I'm in my lecture room at Stanford. And even in a seminar where we just have 15 people around the table, there's this very much of a feeling of who's a professor and who's not. And in these classes, it's much more of a group activity. And this leads me to my third point, which is there's much greater opportunity for teaching. And it's always been my sense that there's lots and lots of people in the world who have expertise in something, and you might want to learn from them, but there's not that much opportunity for them to participate in the educational process. And I think it's really important, you know, as we re-examine the academy, to think about how we can open up opportunities for students to learn from different people and not just professors. And I don't want to put us all out of business, but I think that there is a lot of value that comes from this. And in an environment like the kinds of conversations that we're having, the teacher actually becomes somewhat less important, and the students become much more important, because as I say, this is conversation, so who you're in the class with is really, you know, they're participating just as much as the teacher can be participating. So it's really nice to be able to open up those kind of opportunities. So in terms of, we've had, as I said, 10 of these conversations, and we're sort of having a little Holmesian moment in terms of figuring out what is it that, what kinds of conversations are people the most interested in, and trying to have more of those. I'm going to restart up in January with a hopefully rich curriculum list, and people are welcome to join us, and we're, you know, try to do our advertising to think about in advance, well, what we're going to offer this class, what kind of people would be interested in it, and go out there, like, for the bloggers. We advertise on a bunch of different bloggers lists and things like that. And what we really want to do is to build a community of learning, and so create an environment where people want to show up regularly, and that it's a group of people from whom you'd always be interested in learning something. So maybe 1 week you're the teacher, the next week you're the learner. It could be on a wide variety of topics, and sort of like taking, you know, Terra Nova, the blog, which is a community of people who get together to focus their conversations in one place, so you can go in and have access to all of them. I do see a lot of similarities between what we're doing in group blogging more generally, and I think it's just sort of a next step in taking advantage of new technologies to increase opportunities for speech generally, for conversations, and we've been focusing on law and technology conversations.
Can you guys hear me? Okay, cool. I guess I'd like to start just by asking, how many people in here are teachers in some capacity, like professors or, okay, wow. Okay, how many people have tried to teach a class using a virtual world, 3D, 2D? Okay.
Oh,
2D. 2D, yeah. And how about how many people plan to at some point, like it's on the horizon for you? Cool, okay. It helps to know that. I don't know if you've noticed, there's been a lot of hype recently about virtual worlds. And so the journalists out there, thank you, by the way. I think it's really cool, the hype. You know, I know a lot of people will sort of backlash against it, but I'm sorry, hype is really good for those of us who are trying to convince administrators to let us do creative things in the classroom. So I am all for the hype. And then we can have panels like this where we get together and we take a closer look at things sort of separate from the hype, right? Like in Photoshop, I love the magnifying glass tool where you've got like a picture or text in Photoshop and it looks really nice and you can kind of zoom in with the magnifying glass. Any graphics program will let you do this. And the closer you get, the fuzzier it gets and you notice that things aren't really connecting. And that's what conferences like State of Play and Terra Nova are for. And so I guess that's what we're doing today on this panel, is sort of differentiating different types of things. And I think one important thing to think about is that there are different types of situations in which people will be trying to use virtual worlds. And it's helpful, I think, to differentiate those. One of those is, obviously it's the things that Doug and Lauren have been talking about are great examples. And then just sort of trying to come up with a typology to describe it, starting in places like Second Life, you have in-world training sessions. You know, in Second Life, people will teach how to craft, or how to make a dancing animation, or how to script. There's even a Gorian dance class, which is a weird subculture in Second Life that actually gets together and dances. That's not what they do. But
they do a
lot of other things too.
Mostly
other things. But they actually have their own dance class. But my point is that it's all within world.
Aaron, what sort of dancing does that involve? Can you tell us a little bit more?
I'm not really familiar with that. Okay. Sorry, man. You can Google Gorian after panel. But the point is that that happens entirely in world, right? There's not really... you can just like drop in. You can search through the directory, say, I want to learn how to script, and bam, somebody's standing there who's going to talk to you for an hour about how to script. They're very helpful, usually volunteering their time to do it. Then you get things that are more like distance education, more like what Lauren's been talking about, where the virtual world is actually replacing the physical classroom or filling in a lot of gaps. You know, if you can't get people together in one space-time place, you can use the virtual world to kind of create this sort of classroom that exists independently of the physical classroom. And those are very exciting projects, and I think we're going to see more and more of those because there's so much of an interest in terms of funding and reducing budgets in distance education, right? Because over the long term, you can really leverage your resources with that sort of thing. And it's very exciting to be a part of it. Then you get more of the blended approaches, which have a physical classroom and a virtual classroom, and in some way you're trying to make connections between those two things. And I know that a lot of people in here have been involved with those types of experiments. That's pretty much what I've been doing. I've used EverQuest 2, World of Warcraft, and Second Life. Every year I get to use it in a class where we have like half of the class is a discussion seminar, and the other half of the class is time spent in that world. And we've used those worlds to study ethnographic research methods, which I should kind of, as a caveat, say it's like ethnography light, not like true hardcore ethnography, but sort of an introduction to qualitative research methods and ethnographic methods. We've done stuff on game design, and next semester we're looking at promotions and activism in virtual worlds. And it's really fun because we can go back and forth between those two spaces. Another type of a virtual world context that you'll see, I think, increasingly is sort of dedicated simulation modules. So somebody has come up with some sort of simulation that happens in the virtual world, and then people can just drop in at any time. So, for example, maybe doctors are trying to work on their bedside manner with patients. There might be a sim that you could drop into in Second Life where you actually get to interact and practice those behaviors. And that's connected to another sort of approach, which you're seeing increasingly in virtual worlds, which is the use of role-playing. I mean, that's certainly nothing new in education or therapy or gameplay, but role-playing as a sort of educational method for trying to teach something or to experiment with something. And one thing I think that we've learned in online games is that non-player characters, you know, computer-controlled role-playing situations can often be pretty bad. The standalone role-playing games are fantastic, but really the most exciting role-playing things happen when you have other human beings behind other avatars and you're both interacting in a virtual space and both people are role-playing. So that's the typology. You've got the in-world activities like scripting classes in Second Life. You've got the hybrid courses. You've got distance education courses. You've got like these dedicated simulation modules, and then you've got sort of these role-playing modules. And these things can mix and match. I'm not suggesting it's like exhaustive or mutually exclusive, but they're different. They're all used in different ways for different applications. And Doug had a really great soundbite, I thought, where he said, "You know, virtual worlds are fantastic for learning, but they're terrible for teaching." And really, what we have to do is just learn to get out of the way. And Lauren basically echoed that, that it becomes much more like a conversation, you know, than a formal lecture situation. And I think that's true. I mean, that's a crucial aspect of understanding how virtual worlds can be effective educational devices, but that doesn't mean that teachers don't have any responsibilities whatsoever. You know, part of what a teacher should do, in my opinion, when teaching with virtual worlds is create a situation in which students can learn. And you have to give up some of that totalitarian control that you have in a lecture. I mean, in a lecture, you can go up there with your 40 PowerPoint slides, every single point, you know, you've just controlled the whole thing. That's a very attractive and actually misleading form of control, because really the students will just blank out, they're spaced out, they're not paying attention anyway. You have to give up that control. But on the flip side, if you just sort of say, okay, you know, here's Second Life, go out here, learn something about new media, and come back and tell us what you've learned, that's sort of the other extreme, because it's a scary environment to newcomers. And, you know, students need some structure. So I think the role of the teacher is to construct situations and then get out of the way. What are the challenges with this sort of thing? First of all, things will go wrong, right? I think, I mean, people nod your heads if you've tried to teach a class in virtual worlds and things have gone wrong. It's just inevitable, and that's okay. You know, the students, I think, will cut us a lot of slack because they know it's new, and it's, you know, more interesting to them probably than, you know, most traditional lectures. So if things go wrong, it's not a big deal, and you can actually invite the students to be involved in debugging the course as you go. You know, hey, that discussion last week didn't really work, you know, what could we do next time to make it more effective? And students really are the best feedback on what's working and what isn't. Another problem or challenge that you might face, I think, is computer literacy. You know, there's a tendency to think that young people necessarily are like computer jocks. And I hear that all the time, like, oh, kids these days, these college students, they're like a new breed of technology cyborgs. It's changing, but, you know, I have every semester a number of students who are very freaked out by technology. And it takes a lot of courage for them to take a class that's clearly technology related, and then you get these sort of technology jocks sitting around them, you know, who know a lot about it. And it's really tricky to manage that balance, to encourage the students who haven't mastered the technology yet, that they're capable of doing it, and then also to intercept the computer jocks. And, you know, they're male, they're female, the game jocks who come in who are like, oh, I've got four 60th level characters, and wow, and I've been playing Ultima Online since I was 8, and, you know, then the timid student is sitting there kind of freaked out because they're next to, you know, they don't even know what 60th level is, but it sounds good. So you can get those computer jocks, I think, really, you know, kind of pull them aside, and even if you can identify them before the class starts, encourage them to come in as tutors or trainers, and just say, hey, you know, you've got a lot of information to share. Some of your cohort classmates are going to be freaked out. What can you do to make it easier for them? And they really, almost every time, I've seen that work really well. I think it really helps a lot. A final problem, I think, or not a final problem, but another problem I wanted to mention is convincing students that it's okay to use virtual worlds and game-like spaces as homework environments. I've had a really difficult time getting students to go back to their dorm room and, like, play. You wouldn't think this, but getting them to go back and play WoW for 5 hours a week is actually pretty difficult, or getting them to go dive into Second Life, sometimes because their computer just won't run the software because of the graphics requirements, but also because I think there's a sense that if it's game, if it's fun, it must not be homework. And so one thing I would recommend to get around that, if it works in your situation, you know, film classes often have like a mandatory viewing night every week where people have to come together, and tonight we're going to watch Citizen Kane. You can do the same thing, have a mandatory gaming session if you have access to a computer lab. And obviously that requires access to a computer lab, but that can be really fun, and then you can get them to do the sort of homework stuff as a group together, and you can be there as well. It takes a lot of time, but it's fun. And the last point I wanted to make is that there's a lot of research out there on how to do these things, and so for those of you who have done it or moving forward, you probably know about these resources, but some places to look. One is the Terra Nova site, has some great articles linked to it. The work of Constance Steinkuhler is fantastic, and she also is involved with the Games and Learning Conference in Wisconsin, which happens in July. that you might want to check out. Also, Lisa Galarno's work is up there, and I have an article up there as well. The New Media Consortium is a fantastic resource, nmc.org. They've got an island that a lot of people think is closed to people who aren't part of the consortium, but as I understand it, you can actually visit and participate in events. So, yeah.
You just join the group, and then you can go.
Excellent. Yeah, you just join the group in Second Life. It's like NMC. If you just search for NMC or New Media Consortium, you should be able to find it and join it. The SL Second Life Educators list is incredibly active. I recommend you go for the digest form or the mailbox will just explode. But even if you're not using Second Life, if you're using There or EverQuest 2 or World of Warcraft, a lot of those ideas are really transferable to other environments. And then lastly, there's this whole body of research on text-based MUDs and education and online classrooms. It goes back to the late 80s, probably even back before that. And I mean, just because we're now in three dimensions doesn't mean that those lessons don't still apply. So hopefully that will be helpful.
Okay, well, thank you all. Are there questions that people want to ask of our panelists? Yeah.
Go ahead.
No.
I want to thank you guys for bringing this up. You, especially Aaron, you really complexified the entire arena. We'll think about educating in virtual worlds, and then you've got educating in games, and you've got distance education, and you've got some of that's not distance education. You're dealing with these kids on a daily basis in the real world and the virtual world. There's so many different factors that go into this. I want to raise two main points. I really loved Doug's point about games are great at for learning, and not great for teaching. And then almost combine that with Lauren's approach, where she's looking to teach. She's got very specific content that she's looking to get across. And I'm trying to figure out, there's an intersection between these two approaches, because I'm not entirely convinced that I'm an educator in a virtual world, I use Second Life on a daily basis to teach. I'm not entirely convinced that these are the best platforms for taking our classic pedagogical approaches. Like you're saying, educators need to get out of the way. I love that you said that, Aaron. It's very important. But is there some, what can we draw from games and how good games are at having people learn things and figuring out how to fuse that with, well, what do we actually want to teach? We're educators. And there are specific goals that we have. It's great that learns that games have people learning things. What if it's not what we want them to learn, then it's not really meeting our needs and our interests. So I'm wondering if any or all of you have thoughts on that.
Let me back away a little bit to what I said. I don't think that games are any better or any worse than a lecture or a book or those kind of things at direct transfer. It's just not a very interesting question to me. It's something we know how to do pretty well in a lecture format or a text format or any of those kind of things. So I think as educators working in virtual worlds, my point is more that we need to be looking at the things that virtual worlds can do that classrooms can't. So I'm being intentionally provocative when I say they're terrible at teaching. They're not terrible at teaching. There's not any better or any worse. The same way a car is not a better or worse storage device than a shed. It's just got better applications like transportation. So we need to think about what virtual worlds can do for us in that context that can kind of push education forward. And I think those things lead us away from the direct transfer model. Distance education obviously is one of those applications that works pretty well in terms of direct transfer. And I also don't want to suggest there aren't things that should be taught by a direct transfer. Right? I mean, there's all kinds of literature about scaffolding in education, where there are certain things, it's a terrible way to teach, basic math to have kids explore numbers, right? I mean, you want to sit down and say 2 plus 2 is 4, 4 plus 4 is 8, right? I mean, and that gives them the scaffolding to go on and do more interesting kind of stuff with what they learn. So I don't want to suggest that we should abandon the classroom, all head to World of Warcraft, and that will solve all of our educational crises and no child will be left behind. Quite the opposite. But I want to almost caution against too much of a celebratory
notion that games can somehow solve our problems and can do all of these great things. They can do some great things, but they have to be part of, kind of complement to, a lot of other things we know about education that do work.
I agree. Like, I wouldn't take my Stanford class in privacy law that I teach and put them into the virtual world and teach that class. I mean, that would be, there's way too much technical problems to make that, the transaction costs are just not worth it. So you have to figure out, like, be really clear in advance, like, what value are you getting out of this educational experience? And so, I mean, you can think about, like if I wanted to teach, you know, teach about a book, I can integrate a chapter of the book into, like, if I was, you know, I work with Larry Lessig, if I wanted to teach code, like, stuff from his book, I could assign it as a chapter in a class. I could have him give a lecture on it. I could have the students read it and have their own little book club where they discuss it. Or I could tell them to read it, go out into virtual world, and then come back and tell me what it means to them in the context of what they just did. So some of those would make sense in my classroom, in my brick and mortar building, and some of them would make sense in the virtual world, and they'd get a different experience from every single one of those. And so, you know, I think that if I wanted to teach a privacy class and another university wasn't offering one and their students wanted one, and I allowed them to, and I taught it in a virtual world, the same thing that made no sense for Stanford students might make sense. Or I might want to put those kids in the classroom with some of your students and have, you know, that they can learn together. So I think, I mean, and some of these range from just being, like, fancy distance ed, which I'm comfortable with, to being, you know, creative uses of place. And I think that, you know, what we want to do is try to take advantage across the spectrum of all those things. But there, you know, I have a strong interest in giving education to people who otherwise won't have access to it. And so, you know, technologists who want to know a little bit about copyright law, you know, that I have so many of them. They call my desk every day. They have problems. You know, if there's a way that I could put them in a classroom and get them to solve it. So I think you're right. I think it's very, very important not to use the virtual world for something where the transaction costs are going to be so high that the added value is not worth it.
Yeah.
This is slightly on a different topic, but I've been teaching a course in Second Life this semester, and a lot of educators have been coming to talk to me about the possibility of starting that at their own universities. And one of the things that appears to be a problem, I mean, it's fine when an individual instructor just incorporates it in a class, but when a university wants to start up an island, at least with regard to Second Life, there seem to be some pretty serious problems with people's university general counsels being willing to sign those terms of service agreements. And I don't really know what to say to people about it. I mean, we're just kind of doing it. We aren't using a lot of Harvard marks on our island where we do it, but I think it's a real stopping point for a lot of people who would like to try it out. So I just wonder what you guys, do you have any thoughts about that?
I don't think most educators need an entire island. I mean, it's great to have one, but let me rephrase that. I have never needed an entire island, and there are all these people like the NMC and other people who are setting up sort of like campus-like islands that you're welcome to visit. So I don't know, unless it's a really sustained sort of institutional commitment to education, if there's an overwhelming need to have one. Does that answer your question? Or?
Well, no, not exactly. Okay. I guess what I mean is more that right now we're at the point where we're doing it as individuals, more or less, and so we can sort of do it by fiat. But as universities do seek to establish a more continuing presence in these worlds and to give resources to professors who aren't willing to do the work themselves to learn how to use it, so that there's some kind of setup that's there for them, this actually seems to become a pretty serious issue. It seems possible to me that as educators we could get together and figure out what are the things that we need as universities and present those to the virtual worlds that we want to use, or maybe to pursue something more like the open source metaverses like OpenProKay or something like that.
What exactly are the terms that
the copyright stuff.
But
so
exactly
the,
what
one
I mean,
example
since
is,
since Second Life is so wonderfully open about you getting
well, so what happens if somebody makes a Harvard Harvard T-shirts with the Harvard logo on them and starts selling them? Second Life's position is that you can, you know, like the university wants Second Life to go in and stop them.
Well, they will if you send them a takedown.
That's not exactly the problem I think that people have been expressing to me. The problem is more that, at least with Second Life, that Linden Labs reserves the right to use any of your content that it wants to use for its own purposes, and that includes your lecture material, your video streams, your trademarks, whatever it is that you put in there. For our course, we're making all of that freely available to everyone in the world anyway, so who cares if Linden Labs uses it, but not everybody feels that way about it.
Is it Charles Nissen class?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's another university in Cambridge that whose general counsel had problems with them having students building building together because there was no guarantee that who was going to own that and how. And there, you know, this other university having a strong interest in intellectual property ownership, you know, the very clash of cultures.
Well, just from my own experience, where we've had students come and build things, and we wanted to reserve the rights to be able to use it and refer to it in our own work and our documentation. We set up our own user agreement in that case, and that's something that's very easy to do.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sorry,
can you elaborate on that?
So, we held a virtual summer camp called Camp Global Kids, and we wanted to have the ability to document this very extensively through video and text, all the chat logs, pretty much everything. And at the start of the camp, all the applicants needed to agree to that we're able to use content they produced in our own documentation, and that we had rights to that. We didn't say that, you know, anything you produce we own. I mean, we didn't, we're interested in that, but whatever your purposes are, you want to reserve the right to your curriculum, you know, or to document what your students are building, you can create your own user agreement.
Are you Barry?
No, I'm Robin.
Okay.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I think the problem, though, is not between users, it's between Linden Labs and the... So if this other entity in Cambridge comes up with great research, you know, these are research institutions that make a lot of money off of, you know, technology transfer of what they come up with. So if they come up with something in Second Life, are they going to retain the right to patent it? Or does Linden Labs somehow have some sort of interest in it that prevents that from happening? So that
Ted, I think, was first.
Is there a World of Warcraft educators list? I mean, does anyone teach a course anywhere other than in Second Life? Has anyone done that? Why is everybody teaching in Second Life? I guess that's the question.
I mean, I did in Galaxies, which was a very different experience.
Why is there such interest in teaching within Second Life in particular? What advantages does that? Or what is it about the fantasy games that makes it seem like it's not a place to do this virtual teaching?
I've taught three classes in fantasy environments and one in Second Life so far. And next semester I'll use Second Life. I mean, part of it depends on the context. I mean, if I'm teaching students to do ethnographic research with fantasy gamers, especially a fantasy environment makes sense. For me, the exciting thing about Second Life is the tools for building and creating content. Obviously, there are some IP issues that need to be sorted out, but the tools themselves are amazing. It's just, I mean, it's like two totally different worlds.
I think there were a couple of responses or other questions.
Well, I was going to say Second Life lets you modify the environment to your needs, and I don't have a preset, I don't have any rules, which can be, it's actually, I found out that the gamers in my class were very disturbed by that, and the non-gamers liked it. So I thought the gamers would have an easier time with Second Life, but they didn't, because they just had already a set of expectations that the people who weren't really familiar with virtual worlds didn't have. And I found that it was in a non-competitive environment. There are a lot of other educators there that you can go visit. We visited Harvard, we visited Global Kids, and give the students a perspective of what can be done with this meat.
Ren, I think, was next to mention.
I was going to say, us as a lot of educators in the room with a common need, an issue with the EULA, there's a lot of lawyers in the room, also educators, and there's a fine tradition of things like tax revolts, etc. Couldn't we maybe use a piece of technology to agree what the EULA change clause should be and just send it to Lyndon and say, could we have that? This would actually suit us. You know, I mean, they have a limit, say, they force license for their, it's non-commercial use of copyrighted articles, and say, for educators, let's propose this.
You can't see it, Ren, but Josh is jumping up and down at the thought of recrafting the EULA. Thanks for volunteering, Josh. That's great. Hey, you really should see his face.
It's a good idea.
Clearly so excited about all of it.
Only we had an attorney who specialized in intellectual property.
If only there were one in the room, alas.
Well, could we actually just say the SL Educators Forum could start with that on that if there were any lawyers on it? And just to actually do it.
You need to negotiate the institution to institution, Lyndon being an institution, and Harvard being an institution, and they could come up with a EULA between themselves just for that.
This could be a common need.
Well, but also part of the problem, isn't it, that we've found with this education thing is that the university's initial response is, we're going to make lots of money out of this. There's billions of dollars at issue here. And then they're sort of like, and even if there's not, there are liability issues about the use of our mark. We don't want Harvard socks on T-shirts, and you know, it all gets driven by the commercial interest of both. I mean, it's not, you know, Lyndon, okay, has got all sorts of problems, but it's not just them, it's the universities that also business, you know, businesses in themselves. I mean, it's a really intractable, well, it's not intractable, it's a very difficult problem. And not everybody wants to go open source.
Yeah. I have a response to Aaron. Actually, I agree with what he says about the tools in Second Life. Because my approach is I like to take two extremes. You know, I have an economics background, so I'm thinking crafting at one end and the creation at the other end, and everything happens in between. Sometimes you have some crafting and creating, sometimes you have more creating, no crafting at all. Actually, I'm good at drawing. Can I get a chart? You know,
yeah. Yes, of course.
It's easier to, you know, explain what I'm talking about. And it's like, you know, here we have creation and yeah, crafting.
What do you mean by crafting?
Huh?
What do you mean by crafting?
You level up. You know, you play you're stuck bound to you know, narrative or story, whatever rules, you know, rules. You have, you know, creation here, you know, pure everything. And you know, goes like this. You know, at some point you have all crafting but no creation at all. At some point you have all creation but no crafting at all. And most of the online worlds, you know, fall in between. You know, you have maybe Second Life here. Maybe there is more like here. You have World of Warcraft here. More, you know, close to full crafting but not totally crafting maybe. And maybe you can put, you know, tail in the desert, you know, somewhere in between, you know. So, and the whole, you know, learning takes place in this, you know, boat, you know, but you don't know if it is better here or it's worse here. And that's what I'm trying to get at. I mean, and boat, you know, extremes. I mean, you don't have any extremes, you know. There's nothing out there that gives you the extreme. Maybe for crafting you have, but for pure creation, you don't have at the moment. But both require some skills, and, you know, both require some kind of a cognitive process. You know, when you start, you know, when you get into those environments, you strategize. You know, you start thinking, you know, what I'm going to do and how I'm going to learn. I mean, you share information and stuff like that.
Man. So let me just interject. You don't think, for example, in World of Warcraft, somebody who says, wow, some of the big guilds are about to hit one of the end instances where they need lots of nature resist gear. I'm going to go farm a bunch of living essence so that I can get good nature resist gear, and I can corner the market on the auction house, mm-hmm. and I can make a huge amount of money by being able to craft these goods in these particular kind of ways.
No,
you don't think that's a sophisticated form of learning?
It is. I'm not saying it is good. I mean, if learning is better here or it's better here.
Yeah. It's different objectives. What do you want them to learn may be better suited by the crafting environment than by the creation.
Or creation environment. And the thing is, also you act in a creative way when you craft. You know, I'm not ruling that out. But here, you know, when you create, you have, you know, there's another different cognitive process, you know, takes place. You have to share information. I mean, you share information also here. But, you know, it's all different. That's why your paper was very interesting, you know, about divergence triggering, you know, all that transferring, you know, knowledge out, you know, in and out, that kind of thing. That's, you know, that's what I'm working at the moment, you know, as a dissertation. And that's when Aaron said, you know, I have tools, you know. I like Second Life because it has tools. It's, you know, really, you know, it may give you more tools, but you're never sure that if it is a better learning or not, very better transfer of, you know, knowledge or whatever you have.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my
thing. Thank you. Also, Gene, I think you're
next. I'm really intrigued by the idea of thinking about teaching and learning in a different way, and I'm curious what ideas you have about how we're going to develop these new skills and attitudes towards how to use these environments in the most effective way possible. I really like, Aaron, what you were saying about that there's got to be some balance between just the kind of learner-centered activities and teacher-centered activities, just because ultimately if we're trying to teach, then you do want people to have goals. And in reflecting on that, it seems to me that the skills that we need to develop are something along the lines of being able to structure the environment so that when people do have the freedom to explore, that you can kind of predictably expect that they're going to learn certain things. And it seems to me that when you think about what game crafters are doing, that's exactly what they're doing. And, of course, there's times when you set up a quest, and then the players go off and do completely the wrong thing, and you have to kind of troubleshoot that. But that seems to me like the kind of skills that we would need to adopt in order to think about teaching effectively in this medium. And, you know, what can we be doing to set up some kind of mechanism of learning that? Can we learn that from the game designers? Is there some way to set up some kind of knowledge exchange there, or a craft exchange, or apprenticeship, whatever it is that takes to get that skill and attitude set over?
I think apprenticeship is a good word to describe the type of learning that happens in those spaces that students experience. They are like apprentices in a community of practice. And the best work, I guess, I could recommend for sort of getting a more systematic explanation of this idea is, I don't know how to pronounce the name, I think it's Lev and Wenger, isn't it? Lev and Wenger from 91 on situated learning sort of lays it all out. And then the work that Constance Steinkeller is doing at Wisconsin also elaborates on it. And Jim G also. And so it's a little more systematic than what we've talked about here, and that would probably be a good starting point.
Richard, do you want to?
This is a question for Doug, really. You said that games are good at teaching dispositions. They're good at teaching things like facts as well.
Yeah.
But they're good at teaching dispositions. The trouble is that games as things that are good at teaching dispositions is the argument that the people use against games when they say they're for violence and all this kind of thing. They're teaching our children violent attitudes through the games. And so is there something that we can say, well, actually, the dispositions that we're teaching them are above that, or they're not that kind of disposition, or is it actually the case that we really are teaching students, players to be I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think the work, for example, that tries to find connections in terms of aggression, I see that as a direct transfer problem, right? And I think that dispositions are much more about things like organizing social relations. They're not about, I mean, Ryle talks about the difference between a dispositional and an episodic kind of stance. And the idea of teaching violence would be, for Ryle, episodic. Right.
Yeah, but it could be that it's teaching a lax attitude to the law, for example.
Yes, it could be. I mean, I think that's right. I don't think that everything we do in virtual worlds is bright and cheery and wonderful. I don't think grief play is a great disposition, but I do think people develop it, for example. So, I mean, I think that we have to be careful. And I don't want to be in a position where I'm saying, no, the only thing that happens in virtual worlds is good stuff, right? I don't think that they have the kind of impact that I don't think games make kids go shoot up schools, right? I don't find it terribly surprising that kids that go shoot up schools would also play violent games, right? But that seems to be a different kind of question, right? And that may be a dispositional kind of question, that they have a disposition that fits with, you know, those kind of things. So, I mean, it's tricky. That's something that needs to be worked out and negotiated because, my impulse is to want to disavow any of that kind of what I see as kind of nonsensical school shooting kind of research and try to reposition all of this back within an understanding that the kind of learning that happens in these spaces is in some ways teaching people how to learn more than it is teaching any particular kind of behavior or action as having rewards or benefits. That's probably not a very satisfactory answer.
No, well, I mean I'd say that. It's as if there's a scale of things that games that can be taught, and at the bottom there's facts like names of phrases and so on, and then it gets further up. And then there's this big gap that games just can't handle, and then at the top there's a bunch of high-level meta abilities and skills which games are very good at, but they're difficult to do in a classroom situation. And where does the games teach people to disregard human life as important fit in? Is that a meta skill, or is that one of these middle things that games can't actually touch, even if they wanted to?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. If you go back to a kind of notion of conceptual blending, there is no human life in games, right? They also don't teach you that you can rez if you get hit by a car, right, in real life. And I think in the middle, the thing that we're talking about are practices. We're talking about being attuned to other people, right? That it matters when I go on a raid. If I see a priest, walking into a group of mobs, I know that he's going to go get aggro, and I need to heal him, or I need to draw aggro off, or those kind of things. So a kind of heightened sensitivity to contextual awareness might be one of the kind of practices that I develop. The ability to listen to other people, the ability to balance skill sets, that I know when I go into an instance, I need to have, a tank and a healer and DPS or whatever it is, right? So I think those things in the middle, even learning about things like agency, right, and developing senses of agency, I don't want to say dispositions are things like disregard for human life or love of human life, for that matter. I think they're more akin to things like play styles. About regarding what kind of connections are important and what kind aren't, how you use information, what kind of information is valuable and what kind of information isn't. So I would always want to tie them back to practices of social interactions.
We've been in such a defensive position with games for obvious reasons. I mean, it's so polarized, right? We're afraid to say, like, a game could be bad, that this violent scene or this violent activity or behavior in a game could be bad. But I think as educators, we can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't say games are these wonderful teaching tools. They're going to like teach you new dispositions or new ways of solving problems. But they don't do anything bad. They can only teach you good things. And, I mean, if we're really going to be honest, and, I mean, I I think we are being honest here, you know, they can do both.
There are a series of questions. I think I'll also.
I was recently at a demo by Tata Interactive. Have you, any of you heard of that company? They're based in India. They're part of the Tata, really big multinational conglomerate, one of the wealthiest companies in India, responsible for a lot of the outsourcing services in India and elsewhere in the world. And they showed us a simulation program for decision making that is used to teach business school students how to make business decisions. And they gave us a 40-page document we had to read before going to the demo, which laid out a description of the company that we were going to be, whose fate we were going to determine by the decisions that we made about the problems that the company was facing. And then they organized us in the room into companies, but they made us compete against one another. They gave us a situational memo describing the crisis that had befallen the company. Then we went into their simulation environment on laptops, and we had to plug in the decisions that we had made. We formed the board of directors of the company and assigned roles to each other. Somebody was the president. I was in charge of marketing and public relations, and, you know, whatever skills we brought to the table. And then we went and plugged in the numbers, and we went through two rounds to save the company. And actually, my team, and we were all nonprofit executives, we won the contest. So it was really interesting because none of us had a really strong finance background. But when we got to talking to the German mathematician who developed the algorithm that allows these number crunching, he said, I talked to him about Second Life and these virtual worlds, and said he knew nothing about it. But it seemed to me a natural marriage, you know, if we could bring in the role-playing power of the virtual world and the rich database that allows you to make decisions and see the real-world impact of, you know, business decisions, that would be a terrific teaching tool.
And moreover, I think one of the things that games are great at teaching is unexpected consequences. So you can play out lots of different scenarios, and you can watch the other team not do as well. And you can figure all those kind of things out with almost zero real-life cost. You get immediate feedback, and you can have catastrophic results in-game that are kind of trivial. I mean, they're not, and maybe emotionally non-trivial to you, or grade-wise non-trivial to you, but... you know, nobody dies, no companies go bankrupt, any of those kind of things. So, but you can play out lots and lots of different scenarios. I think simulations are really good for that. I think that's a great example.
I think that to say something about simulations, because I've been thinking about this question Gene asked for a while, which is like, you know, how can we teach law differently using the virtual world? And I think there, you know, after thinking about it, there's really a big difference between like simulation and like just using the virtual world to learn something itself. So, for example, I was in a plane flying over an area, and all of a sudden we all fell out of the plane because somebody had set up a no-fly zone over their house. And it was like fascinating. It was like a learn about property rights in a way that was just completely different. Or, you know, we've had like in there, you could change this setting, but if you type like F-U-C-K, there's like exclamation marks. And it's like there's interesting things you can think about the First Amendment and censorship, and you can think about, you know, what happens if you burn a flag in a virtual world, you know. So there's things like that. And then there's simulations, which I think are actually a little bit different, which is, you know, you can recreate a case or the facts. It's a different kind of thing. So I've been trying to think about differently about simulations versus like engagement with the world as learning about, you know, learning something different. And I think that you know, this was a lesson that was told to me by somebody who built a virtual world. And so it's interesting. I think those are two different ways that things like this are developed.
Tim.
Yeah, and I just putting this all together, because it's all been, you know, these are really interesting kinds of issues, and you guys explore them really powerfully. But when I think about it, it seems to me that, you know, there's almost two really different kind of challenges here if we're going to try and talk about games and learning. And one is, it seems to me there are a set of things where we can be really quite intensely specific about the pedagogical good under a particular circumstance that working with games is going to provide. So like if I'm doing a class on media forms or the history of media or representation or textuality, it's a no-brainer, right? I mean, I don't. There's nothing. I shouldn't have to put on my armor to explain to somebody why we're doing a session in World of Warcraft under those circumstances, because it's the subject matter of it. And it's always good, in a sense, to experience something that makes you look at the subject matter differently. If I'm involved in distance education, it's a no-brainer that this might be something to explore. Maybe this is a new way to supply goods across distance. Okay, we know that. That's a technological possibility of the form. And I think if I'm involved in a sense, learning that is about iteration and experimentation with minimal consequences, things that can't be done in the real world. I mean, even stuff like, you know, recreating Stanley Milgram-esque things that we're no longer allowed to do, unfortunately, much as I actually think we should be. You can make a case that this is a thing that can do this in a way that nothing else can, precisely because it's virtual. But a lot of the other claims, in the sense that I think you guys are making, strike me as a good case where we actually ought to not be isolating games. And I think, Aaron, you were saying this. Not be isolating games from a broader struggle over the question of what is education or what is pedagogy. I mean, that in a sense, there's nothing special about games as a form of situated learning in one sense or another. I mean, the claims that Doug's making, in a way, are claims that I would make for critical thinking as a concept in a liberal arts environment. I mean, that I would say, this is why I don't want to have a pedagogy that is, in a sense, about narrow forms of knowledge transfer and is about, in a sense, experience and is about situated learning and is aiming ultimately for critical thinking as its end goal. Like, that I'm more concerned that most of the time that my students know how to think about a problem and know how to be autodidacts in some new way, and less concerned with what exactly did they learn that they can take a, you know, multiple choice exam on and pass. So there's a way in which for those kinds of claims, I actually in a way would want to kind of not have to make any special claims for games and simply say, this is one more thing that is part of a much larger, really, you know, intense debate about what is education and what should it be. And where I think, you know, we know who the asshats are in that debate that we don't want to have to give any court to, you know, the very narrow back to basics, you know, et cetera manifesto. But there are other people who were, you know, parents even, when they say to me something like, so you say in a liberal arts college that it's part of the educational experience for students to be in student groups and to be doing critical thinking and what does that mean? My kid is going to end up, you know, like the most educated burger chef or something like that. I mean, I actually kind of take that seriously. In other words, there are critiques of situated learning and of processual learning and experiential learning that I think are hard to answer to, but they're no harder around games than they are around any other way that we talk about or defend projects of kind of learning that aren't about narrow knowledge transfers.
And I would want to add one small element, which is what I see happening around, for example, people building their UIs in World of Warcraft, or people building out spaces in Second Life. I mean, I think that is slightly different than what you can do in the classroom. I think there is a way in which you can bind that critical horizon with a productive horizon. And I think that is a step, forward's the right word, but it's something different. And I think it's something we're only beginning to explore as a kind of pedagogy. Right? The idea of people building stuff is not one that has had a lot of play, for example, the humanities.
Right, but how would that be different from, let's say, making students write essays? I mean, it's just that one is a more conventional exercise of making use of what you're doing. And in a way, I'm prepared to say I think the building you're talking about is better, like thumbs up. In other words, it's a literacy that our students may be able to do more things with, frankly, than writing another fucking essay.
I think the media literacy movement, you know, has had as its central premise the idea of coupling kind of creative production with critical analysis, with video cameras or tape recorders. And I think, yeah, what Doug's talking about is a great example of that.
Brian, I teach law, and I teach it on three levels. One level is the direct transfer of knowledge, kind of like grinded out. This is what Section 61 means, and this is what basis means. Another level is the critical thinking level. I want my students as lawyers to be able to engage in text and read it in a way different than poets. But the third level I teach at is kind of how do you feel about being a lawyer? And this is kind of my liberal arts background trying to bring it into the trade school environment that is Texas Tech School of Law. And so I teach a class in legal history and teach a class in slave law. And I try to make my students think about how it feels to be a lawyer advocating a law which everyone now says, well, that's just so immoral, that's horrible, how can you treat humans as property? And so what I end up doing, unfortunately, is in 12 weeks I've convinced them to be good little lawyers in antebellum in America and go ahead and enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. I thought initially, well, I'm failing because I need to put them in something more immediate, more drastic than slave law. So I take the last 2 weeks and I put them as lawyers on an island, the Guernsey Islands, which are the only occupied territory of Britain. And they're common law attorneys who are being asked by the bailiff to take away a hotel run by a Jewess. Is this woman a Jew within the meaning of the Nazi statute against the Jews? I try to put them in role. I give them the documents. I kind of say, respond to this. I'm trying to get them to feel, what does it feel like to be a lawyer? And this might be legal ethics, I don't know whether you call it that or not. I'm discouraged in my results because I can't draw the magic circle. And I'm looking to virtual worlds. How can I, because none of them, I mean, they have all these conceptions about what, some of them imagine, you know, well, they have to respond in a certain way because there are Nazi stormtroopers right at their door, which wasn't in fact the case. I mean, this is like Vichy France, and there's a lot of play in the joints. How do I, what tools would I use or could I use that might help my student, put them in a situation with a low-cost resolution, right?
Yeah.
No one's going to actually go to the gas chamber, although four Jews in Guernsey actually did go to the gas chamber. Help me.
That's a hard situation. I mean,
it's
in any
a great
environment.
Situation.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but it's, yeah.
I teach law too. I don't know how you get students to feel like lawyers. I work with our clinical program where we, you know, have them interact with people, and we've talked about doing a negotiation, online dispute resolution type class in there where they would actually go in and resolve member disputes. And, you know, to try to do that or, you know, go around. I've talked with journalists about teaching, you know, journalism school by actually going out interviewing people. So, but again, this goes, I mean, you can create a simulation. You know, you can have somebody design exactly what you described and by being in-world and interacting with characters that are programmed to give certain answers. But again, that goes to the difference between the simulation and the, how do you take what's already out there in these worlds and make people interact with the natives who are there in a way that is lawyerly and so brings more value to them. I'm not sure. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot too. I'm not sure how that would work.
Maybe week 15 on the syllabus assigned Edgar's Game.
I think that just
that's what I'd like to. I would like, ideally, in my mind, I'd like to say, okay, there's a little island in Second Life I can assign them to go to, and the island is a recreation of Guernsey Island, and there will be the characters on the island who give them, and so they'll all have the same context in which to respond. But right now, they're all in their imaginations, and they're responding how they imagine it would be for them. And this is a valuable exercise, nonetheless. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we have good discussions. They come away with the feeling, gosh, you know, lawyers can really suck, parasites. But and I'll never be that.
Right. I think this is a very interesting and important scenario, but, you know, one thing is, to me, the biggest challenge there has nothing to do with the technical aspects of, do you do it in the classroom or the game world, and it's not about, you know, the game design aspect. It's about telling students to assume this role. I mean, role-playing is a really powerful thing to do. That's why therapists use it, too, right? And teachers use it. And it can be really hard for students, too, to put them in certain roles. So I would just kind of put, like, overarching caution, independent of media, you know, you need to be sensitive to how's the student going to feel.
Just not so much caution, it's that, I mean, in a sense, this is what historical reenactors do in non-virtual environments. And actually, what's really striking about reenactors is they're materialists. I mean, they're all essentially fetishists of the material, and none of them actually know how to feel as past people. So, I mean, the problem of mentalité, let's say, in this case, is not a It's not contingent on how we do reenactments, whether they're in virtual spaces or real ones. It's something else. It's another problem.
Well, we have to be careful about coupling power with, like, forced role-playing. I want you to role-play an impressive Nazi. I mean, you know, there should be an opt-out, I think.
Have you tried to reverse the role so the Nazi becomes the Jew? How does that feel now?
They're lawyers. I want them to role-play being a lawyer in a society with an unjust law. And now they're being asked to enforce that law, which they don't think is, and they feel is illegitimate in a fundamental sense. How should they respond? As a lawyer, as a human, do they step out of role as a lawyer? Do they stay in role as a lawyer? That's what I'm trying to get at in the pedagogy. And that's
okay. I'm just gonna stop this. There's time for one more question. There's not time, but we're gonna do it.
Well, I'll make it quick. So I've been working for about a year on this project in Second Life, and if you're in Second Life, visit Casablanca Island. That's our project. It's a multidisciplinary project. I teach computer science, but I have art students, business students, hospitality students, all working in this project. One thing I love about the environment is that we can do so many things that we can't do in the real world. So my question for the room is, I mean, as a professor, teaching is what my primary goal is, but I also spend a lot of time developing evaluative criteria. So now that we can do all of these new things, what is everyone doing to fairly and objectively evaluate the learning that's happening in that environment? So that's my question.
Second that.
Have I
stumped this? Excellent. All right, good. Well, seems like you can take up that question over lunch. Also, I'm going to be proposing the No Child Left Behind Act should be changed to the No Child Doesn't Make It to Level 60 Act. Thank you very much.